Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Petrified Podcast. I'm your host, Damian Martinez, here with my co-host,
Eric Lover.
Thank you so much for tuning in once again. We hope you enjoyed last week's episode of Zozo the Devil, or Zozo the Demon.
The Ouija board demon.
Hope we gave you a little bit of creeps, you know. Maybe you're working late at night and you kind of, make you feel like somebody's watching you. So we hope you enjoyed last week's episode. This week, though, great episode that we have for you today. So April 3rd, John Carpenter finally
got his walk on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Got a star, yeah, finally.
We were actually going to do a film, and we had a film all in mind. And then, lo and behold, the day after we recorded last week, we got the news that he finally got, you know, his star on the walk.
Yeah, finally.
So we're like, oh, man, we've totally got to, you know, give him his flowers from a couple, couple of John Carpenter fans.
Talk about his legacy. But before we talk about his legacy, make sure follow us on Instagram. Link will be in the description of this episode. Make sure you rate, review where you can. Share our podcast with anyone and everyone. Now let's get into the legacy of John Carpenter. And these are pulled from johncarpenter.com, his website, where he has not just, you know, a list of his movies, but also his themes from his other movies.
All of the score work he did for films and shorts. And
yeah, it's a pretty cool, like, little website that he's got going on, man. And he just came out with another Lost Themes record. So go check that out. Go give it a click. Give it a buy. He's not a sponsor or anything. Just, you know, spread the word. So this is coming straight from his biography on his website. While attending the University of Southern California School of Cinema, John Carpenter began work on Dark Star, a science fiction comedy short that was later expanded into a feature-length film and released theatrically in 1975. His second feature, Assault on Precinct 13, released in 1976, was partially an homage to his idol, Howard Hawks, and basically reimagined that director's Rio Bravo in an urban setting. Carpenter's breakthrough film was Halloween. Of course, we all know that. In 1978, the seminal horror film made for $300,000. It was the most profitable independent movie of its day, and to date has spawned several sequels. More than several.
Yeah, and we actually found out, you know, through doing, you know, obviously this review, that there were multiple shorts.
Yeah, I never knew that.
I never knew that there were that many. I knew there were little short stories, and I knew that's kind of like where he had wanted to go, and we've discussed this multiple times with Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
Yeah.
He kind of wanted to take the Halloween series, and he didn't want to focus predominantly on Michael Myers. He kind of wanted to diversify.
Kind of do it like a
Friday the 13th series, or Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side. Yeah. And so he wanted to do that, and he didn't want to be a one-trick pony with just Michael Myers.
Yeah.
But the fans, he found out that they just literally, like, they only wanted one thing.
Yeah, they only wanted Myers. They
didn't want a smorgasbord of food. They just wanted McDonald's chicken nuggets.
Yeah, and of course now it's become
a
huge cult classic, I would say. People are starting to come around to it now, especially, I guess, it being sprinkled now in the later, you know, films. You know, the 2018 reboot, I guess you could say. And it's now, you know, those masks are thrown in. The Silver Shamrock's been thrown in. So now it's starting to become, like, you know, a favorite of people's now.
Yeah.
Following Halloween, he further established his reputation with such genre hits as The Fog, They Live, Prince of Darkness, the psychological horror film In the Mouth of Madness, Christine, and The Ward. His rank as an action director on a wider scale is also evident in such productions as Escape from New York, Vampires, The Thing, Ghosts of Mars, Escape from L.A., and Big Trouble in Little China, probably one of my favorites of his. His motion picture credits also include the comedy thriller Memoirs of an Invisible Man, the sci-fi love story Starman, which earned Jeff Bridges a Best Actor Oscar nomination, and Village of the Dam, the terrifying remake of the classic 1950s horror story. For the small screen, Carpenter directed the thriller Someone's Watching Me, the acclaimed biographical miniseries Elvis, and the Showtime horror trilogy John Carpenter Presents Body Bags, which is probably one of my favorites too. He also directed two episodes of Showtime's Masters of Horror series. He won the Cable Ace Award for writing the HBO movie El Diablo. In the gaming world, he co-wrote, and I never knew this. Of course, I was a little bit younger at the time. He co-wrote the game, video game Fear 3 for Warner Brothers. In the world of comics, Carpenter is the co-creator of the award-winning bi-monthly series John Carpenter's Asylum and the acclaimed annual anthology collection John Carpenter's Tales of Halloween Night. On Halloween 2014, the director and composer introduced the world to the next phase of his career with Vortex, the first single from Lost Themes, his first album of non-soundtrack material. Carpenter's primacy and lasting influence on genre score work was both rediscovered and reaffirmed. Lost Themes achieved numerous international milestones, including NPR First Listen, features in a dozen of press outlets, including the Los Angeles Times, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stones, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Guardian. Three magazine cover and top 200 charts success, 200 chart success in the U.S. and in the U.K. John Carpenter was born in Carthage, New York. His family later moved to Bowling Green, Kentucky, where his father was the head of the music department at Western Kentucky University, which explains a lot
as far as, you know, him being a composer.
Yeah. He attended Western Kentucky University, followed by the USC School of Cinema in Los Angeles. WKU awarded him an honorary doctorate in 2007. He lives in Hollywood, California with his wife, Sandy King, his frequent collaborator. So, yeah, that's John Carpenter right there. I mean, there's probably way
more. Oh, absolutely. And the funny part is that, you know, you're explaining all of this and we're telling you, like, all of, you know, obviously his massive body of work. And it's like, really? Truthfully, he just now got a star on the Walk of Fame?
Yeah, which is wild.
Yeah. We were kind of talking, you know, talking about people who have obviously gotten stars before him, and it seems kind of ridiculous, but...
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I think he was...
Vince Vaughn and Ludacris were far more deserving, you know, before, you know, John Carpenter, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, I was glad, you know, it was long overdue. Like, hey, man, finally, you know. But also finding out that a lot of other people who, not saying they didn't deserve it, but compared to his line of work versus their credits.
Yeah, also, you know, definitely compared to the nature of his work, the fact that it's not just like one trick. It's not just, you know, he's not just a director. He's a composer. You know, he's doing all of these things.
He's a writer.
He's acclaimed in many different facets. And, you know, you get somebody like, no offense to Vince Vaughn. I mean, I'm all about Wedding Crashers and Swingers. But, like, you know, he didn't write Swingers like Jon Favreau. Vince Vaughn was just in Swingers.
Yeah.
But, you know, here 2 years ago, he got his flowers.
Yeah, which I'm glad he did, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not knocking it. But yeah, it's,
but I think, you know, John Carpenter should have probably came before.
Yeah, probably, you know, it's like Bo Jackson, as far as, you know, sports goes. Bo Jackson was in the Raiders. He was in the Royals at the same time. He was, like, diversifying his portfolio.
Yeah.
He was in all these different sports. Now, you know, Trey Smith or something, who played for, you know, the Golden State Nuggets or something. It's like, okay, well, you played one sport. Like, Bo Jackson played three at the same time. Like,
yeah,
you should get your credit before, but, you know.
But, hey, at least now he has.
That's just
it.
My rant. Yeah,
just a rant. Nothing against Vince Vaughn.
No.
Love him. He's amazing. Funny as hell.
Old school.
Favorite one is Dodgeball. I love Dodgeball.
Is that you, Blue?
But let's talk about, of course, what we usually talk about here, some of the movies that he did. Of course, probably later on in our episodes, we will actually touch these movies, you know, independently and actually go in depth. But here we'll just probably talk about some of the few of our favorites and some of the stuff that you have as well. But, I mean, dude, I mean, just looking at the list, I mean, it's a pretty good, like, list of just movies that he's just done.
Oh, yeah. It's just everything, like, I don't know. It was really hard choosing just a couple movies to really, like, find topic points on. So I just kind of, you know, touched on ones that personally, for me, myself, ones that just really stood out to me. Like, for instance, The Fog. The Fog is one of my personal favorites. It was also because I was very young when The Fog came out. I was only 5 years old when The Fog came out. So I grew up in South Los Angeles where, you know, come fall time, we did have fog.
Yeah.
So watching the fog come in.
Oh, and, dude, and adding that creek. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Dude,
I mean, I lived next to Point Firman Lighthouse. So we had the lighthouse. Then, of course, we had a port of call. We had port of call. And that was where we'd kind of go, like, on family trips. We'd go shopping in San Pedro. We'd go to port of call. And when we would go there, there were these old, you know, sea portraits and old, you know, ships in a bottle. And, like, all this old-timey stuff that you didn't, you know, see too much in Los Angeles growing up. So there was all of that. And then we had the fog. So you had all these pirate stories and everything, just the culmination of everything coming together. It was more of an experience. It was like the whole life kind of woven together.
Yeah, man. See, that's what I love about movies like that, especially when you're already like in a place kind of that it's already the setting of a movie. It just adds so much more to the movie itself. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, just the levels and the depth of the movie itself. And I actually found something out through, you know, doing the investigation for this about the fog. And the inspiration for the fog, it's really cool. Him and his wife were actually, they took a trip to Stonehenge during a trip to England promoting Assault on Precinct 13.
Yeah.
And while they were at Stonehenge, a fog rolled in, a creepy, eerie fog, according to his accounts, rolled into Stonehenge. Now, that's what inspired the fog, which I thought was cool on multiple levels, because not only did you have the story of the origin of the fog coming from Stonehenge, which is a super spiritually charged place, but then if you look at his later body of work, Stonehenge comes into play in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch,
yeah,
where they have the piece of Stonehenge, and that's where the electricity that's charging the little silver shamrock medallions comes from. So it was like, man, two of my favorites, because Season of the Witch was...
So you have... What, Assault on Precinct 13? So that was 4 years before the fog came out.
Yeah.
So they were promoting that. So he's already has it in his head.
Yeah, it's already living there. So, and the fog, actually, when they first produced it, was too short. The studio felt like it was too short of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my favorite scenes is when you first get into the movie, you see the old man telling, like, the Boy Scout troop the tale while they're on the beach.
Oh, yeah.
When, you know, the basically, they're coming up on the centennial,
mm-hmm.
and he's sitting there and he's recounting the story of the pirates in the ship. You know, obviously not the story that comes forth in the movie of, you know, the leper colony and, you know, Blake being betrayed by the priest. But, you know, that kind of set the setting for the entire movie, was him sitting there spinning a yarn on the beach to the children. What the hell did the troop is doing up at midnight? I don't know, because they're pretty young kids. But, you know, he's sitting there, hey, I'm going to tell you a story. We're out here at midnight, so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, dude, that's just. But it also, it makes you more immersed into the story as well. Like, it gets you.
Oh, yeah, it gets you pumped.
Yeah, gets you pulled in a little bit. For me, man, it has to be Halloween. I mean, that was my introduction to horror in general. You know, I think I've said this before. I don't know if I have or not, but. In our house, we, you know, when we had a family movie night, we never did, like, you know, like just regular family movies or cartoons or whatever. We had, you know, you watched horror movies. That's what it was. And my parents had the VHS of Halloween, all the Halloweens. And so that's what we would watch. So that was Halloween was my first introduction into the horror genre itself. And then, of course, from there, it just goes. But with Halloween, the ambiance of the movie, the sound, the scoring of it, you know, that's what I was intrigued by, because it makes you feel a certain way. I love the scoring in Halloween. And then in Halloween 2,
like when Michael Myers appears and they just hit you with like some creepy, like, you know,
yeah, well, it wasn't that, it was more of the, when he would appear from the shadows and they would do that hard, like, I can't explain the way, but it's like a loud sound, just a shock. Even though he's just doing something as small as, like...
coming through the closet or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just hit you with the...
Yeah, and it just, like, makes you jump, which a jump scare, you know, with visuals and sound is one thing, but just the sound in general, even though he's doing something as small as, like, appearing from the shadows, I'm like, oh, dude, that's what I love about it. And in Halloween 2, I love the score of Halloween 2 too, just capitalizing on the first score, but then making it, giving it a little more, you know, I guess of an 80s feel to it. But yeah, that's my first one. And that's probably always going to be my favorite. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say about Halloween, but that's just...
Yeah, it's literally a landmark.
Yeah,
it's,
of course, you know, there's many, many Halloweens after that, but I think with the first one, second one being my favorite, but with the first one, I mean, that one kicked off the slasher genre. You know, of course, there's, you know, different ones that were around the same time, but Halloween, I mean, that you wouldn't have Jason Voorhees if it wasn't for Halloween. You wouldn't have Friday the 13th because they needed to make a slasher too, and so you get Jason Voorhees, and then there goes the slasher genre.
It's born, and, you know, icons are built, and, you know.
Yeah, and now
everybody's... Build the empire. Yeah. Then, of course, like, I mean, for number two, I think pretty much everybody has to come in on this one. I don't know anyone who really, truthfully, doesn't have this movie in their top five, but it's got to be The Thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the redoing of The Thing from Outer Space, it's just, you know.
Dude, it's so well shot, that one. I mean, it's just, even rewatching it, it's like, dude, it's still done very, very well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the special effects, the dogs, you know, that was great. I can remember that. It introduced me to two people that, I mean, obviously would go on, you know, to further their careers, first being Kurt Russell.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, that was like Kurt Russell's, like, you know, that was his, you know, his quintessential peak, role. Yeah.
And then he would start, I mean, dude, he would have so many other great roles
after that. Yeah, and especially in Carpenter films. I mean, he goes through and he starts off, you know, as obviously, you know, the character in The Thing, and then he blossoms into Snake Plissken.
Yeah.
And you carry Snake Plissken apart, you know, up into Escape from New York. Then, of course, he goes into, you know, come back years later, Escape from Los Angeles.
Yeah, and you got, yeah, Big Trouble with China. You got...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was at such a peak around that time. I mean, he's still good. Don't
get me wrong.
Yeah,
he just caught the Pork Chop Express and just kept moving. I mean, yeah. That's what happened. So, but yeah, it was, you know, the second person in that film that I can remember extremely was, believe it or not, Wilford Brimley. Wilford Brimley, you know, he's like that cool grandpa that, you know, and the fact that, like, I'm obsessed with freight trains, and Wilford Brimley, like, loved freight trains when he was with us. So, you know, that and diabetes. So,
you know, that's right. Yeah.
That being said, you know, it really, you know, he was like the grandfather character, whereas, you know, Kurt Russell was like the cool dad.
Yeah.
But the way that he took the original story, and the original story, not to fault it at all, it was a great story.
Yeah.
It was a great movie. But to bring it into the modern times, and the fact that John Carpenter had such a great, I would say he had like a talent of taking you through multiple different experiences.
Yeah.
Like, Halloween, the whole premise is completely different than The Thing.
Yeah.
Which is completely different than The Fog, which is different than Assault on Precinct 13. So he had such a diversified palette that he could really make any kind of movie and really make it appealing to the broad masses.
Yeah.
So that was like one of the great things, that he took this old film from the 50s and turned it on its ear and made it really, I mean, that's why I think it became such a monumental film as far as, you know, the horror and sci-fi genre intertwined became, was from that movie. So I don't think that, I don't know many people into the horror and sci-fi genre that won't put this movie definitely in their top five, if not top three.
Yeah, it has to be. Yeah, yeah. It has to be. And for me, it was, of course, Kurt Russell, but also for me, Keith David. Dude, Keith David was like, I mean, you used to talk about the cool dad, grandpa and all that. He was like the cool uncle. You know, because, I mean, just both of them complement each other very well in this movie. And then, of course, he would, you know, his freaking line of work in itself, you know, him being the Arbiter in Halo. And then, you know, if you watch Princess and the Frog, he's the, I've not seen the whole thing, but I think he's like the voodoo.
Yeah, dude. I forget the name in the movie.
But, dude, for me, Keith David, I mean, that and his voice, too. I mean, just, and then, of course, the iconic ending of The Thing.
Yep.
And I figured you were going to go with The Thing. For me, it's going to have to be, oh man. See, now you got me thinking. Now I'm rethinking why. I want to say, I'm going to say Big Trouble in Little China. Just because I saw it when I was younger, dude. Pork Chop Express.
The Elementals.
The Elementals, dude. Just what's his name? Oh my gosh, I can't believe I forgot his name. The Asian guy who plays pretty much the villain. And I'm like, dude, just it's
in
just
every single.
he's the Asian villain in like every single
every movie,
every single movie. But dude, just how very fantasy and sci-fi it is, yet it's very comedic and goofy. And again, you're talking about, you know, him pretty much he can take you anywhere. He can just do this whole any genre. He does it with horror, does it with sci-fi, does it with comedy. I mean, hell, Dark Star was horror and comedy. So you do this with, you know, the pork, you know, you get the Pork Chop Express.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's like, even like with Big Trouble in Little China, there was the action aspect, there was the triads, there was the supernatural aspect of having the elementals. There is, you know, it's just everything. It's a microcosm of like 10 different films just jammed into one. And that's what made it so great is, you know, just the way that it hits on so many different points. It's got something for everyone.
Yeah, it's a goofy movie with a bunch of sci-fi stuff in it. And it's just, it's, you know, you got the, I guess you would say the, I want to say stupid, but like the, just pretty much like the dude who's just there, he's a brawler, you know, he's just there to take care of business and get paid.
Yeah, and he's unfazed by like, there's magic all around him. You know, there's these elementals that like shoot lightning and thunder and all these things, and he's just kind of like, I'm still going to punch you in the face. Like, these fists are still stronger.
Because they're telling him, like, he's this and that and this and that, and he's just going along with it. He's somewhat surprised, but other than that, he's like...
Well, they pissed him off. They tried to take his green-eyed Chinese woman.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's the whole pursuit of the whole movie, is that they're, like trying to steal the green-eyed Chinese woman.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to get his friend's fiancée back. And then he falls for a woman in the process of trying to get...
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, it's the Prince Charming, you know, not the new Snow White. But it's, you know, it's the classic fairy tale, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's
Knight in shining armor coming after, you know, the betrothed. And, yeah.
The knight in dirty clothes.
You can't go wrong, you know.
But, yeah, that for me, that one, just because of it just, man, it's just a good movie to watch and just... Just take it in, you know, just like let it take you on an adventure. Yeah, that's mine right there. That's my second one.
My final one, it was a real tie-up. I give the honorable mention to Ghost of Mars, which a lot of people totally slept on. I, as you know, being at least an adult when the movie came out, dude, the main villain, the main Ghost of Mars, totally like scared the hell out of me. It had that whole like dystopic, you know, freaking Mad Max feel to it. And it explained itself very well. But I think if I had to give my overall, I'm going to have to put number three at They Live. They Live had such a social connotation. It's ridiculous. Like, you look at They Live, and essentially what They Live is it's the aliens have invaded, and we can't see that they're aliens.
Yeah.
But Rowdy Roddy Piper comes through, and he's here, you know, to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and he's all out of bubblegum. And so he goes through, and he finds his glasses, and he basically breaks the fourth wall. He can see through the veil.
Yeah, he sees through the veil, yeah.
And he sees that there are these reptilians. And all of the stuff, all of the ads that you see everywhere in society, you know, buy Winston cigarettes, all this crap, it's all like obey, consume. And... like, just the social repercussions that have come from this movie. You had Shepard Fairey with the Obey Project.
Oh, yeah.
And that took over the art world. And he started with Obey. And Andre the Giant has a posse and all this stuff. And it's all right there. But really, to this day, if you tell somebody Obey, they know that that's where it came from. Yeah. And really, John Carpenter doesn't get a whole hell of a lot of credit for that whole deal. Like, no, Shepard Fairey has given him his flowers on it and gone that route.
Yeah.
But the whole feel that there's a whole, it's almost like the Matrix. There's an underground world behind the world that you know, and it's existing, and everybody's running in those veins. And Carpenter really produced this, which is really crazy, because I was living in L.A. at the time, and this was his rebuttal to the Reagan-era politics.
Yeah.
When Ronald Reagan closed down all of our sanitariums, all of our insane asylums, and he dumped everyone out on the street on the Skid Row. and you were literally like walking past lunatics on your way to like, you know, the Santee market.
I can only imagine like how that was.
It was crazy because all the sanitariums dumped everybody out onto the street. And so, you know, Carpenter's showing you, hey, this is not the way the world should be going. And so, you know, living in the area at the time, it definitely had like an effect on me. And like I said, I loved Ghost of Mars, and it was really a strong third. You know, we talked about it. I was voting for Ghost of Mars, but then it was like, man, that one really came in, and just the social ramifications it had demanded that it take the third spot. So
And so that, and I mean, dude, just knowing that, man, you had a wrestler in it. Come on.
Oh, absolutely. Roddy Piper, and you know,
that was going to be my third one. But after rewatching, after quite a while, actually, Escape from New York, that is, I'm going to put that one at my third one, because the casting itself is just, I was rewatch, of course, most of the John Carpenter's movie I've watched when I was younger. Like I said, that's what we would do. So me rewatching them, I'm just like, dude, the casting in this movie is just
Isaac Hayes.
Dude, Isaac Hayes, you had Adrian Barbeau, and you had,
well, he had to put her in, man. That was his wife.
Yeah, but like, as I'm saying, like, I know he had. Yeah.
No, not like Rob but Zombie.
My favorite, you had Lee Van Cleef.
Yeah.
Dude, you had Sabata in there. You had, you know, Good, Bad, Ugly. I mean, that right there was like, dude, that's pretty good. But Harry Dean Stanton, who was an alien.
Yeah, and Repo Man.
Yeah, and Repo Man. You had Tom Atkins, who, of course, would be, you know, is in Halloween 3 as well. We said Isaac Hayes, which if you, for the younger folk, he is Chef off of South Park.
He was Chef.
He was Chef. He left because, you know, the episode of Scientology.
Well, now he's, now he's resting in peace now. But yeah. Yeah, he was very prolific as the Duke of New York.
Yeah. But for the classics, you will know him mainly as Shaft.
Yeah.
Is a bad mother, shut your mouth.
Chocolate salty balls.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, dude, just the casting in general, and they all complement each other very well. Of course, star-studded cast. It's great. And I just love the kind of the gritty, you know, the guy who's been done wrong, and now he's got to, you know, he's
got the government's got to suck up to him to, like, save the president.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, they had an eye patch, dude.
Exactly. Already. Yeah.
Already. It's just a good like little action movie.
Wasn't it Stacy Keach who was like the main police officer? Or I thought it was Stacy Keach. I can't remember. I just remember like the like real ball buster warden type guy who sends him on the mission. Who's basically like, you either do it or I'm gonna shoot.
Yeah, Lee Van Cleef. Yeah. Lee Van Cleef, and then I think you might be thinking of Escape from L.A.
Yeah, that's,
which it was not well received by the fans, and I understand why.
But it did the same thing.
Yeah,
I mean, honestly, like it kind of told the same story, and it was great because Escape from New York obviously had like things that were that native New Yorkers would understand. Escape from L.A. came out, and you had Steve Buscemi, you had Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
You had all these people. You had Pam Grier. You had all these people who were
another star-studded cast.
Absolutely, another star-studded cast. They just took it to the West. So, yeah, it came off well. Yeah, was it extremely similar to Escape from New York? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
and I think that's what it was. Maybe it was too much of similarity. Maybe the fans wanted something different. I enjoy it. I prefer Escape from New York over it, but at the same time, it's just because that's what I saw first.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it came out first, but that's just my preference. But I'm not going to bash it just because.
I think the villain development definitely came across stronger with Isaac Hayes being the Duke of New York than the Che Guevara-esque.
Yeah,
I can't even really remember what the Che-inspired villain was in Escape from Los Angeles. I forget what, and the surf scene, while it was, you know, while it was decent, I didn't really, you know, the shark and I wasn't really feeling that part, but story-wise
is
similar. And casting-wise, it was extremely strong. There were some things, like even me growing up in Los Angeles, I did not surf, I didn't go to the beach. Or I wasn't like, hey, dude, catch 10 snake. And no, I'm not trying to surf and keep my balance with one eyeball. That's not going to happen. But it was, you know, it served its purpose. But like I said, it's got that comedic element.
Yeah, it still does.
Just like you were saying, obviously was present in Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, and it was more hard, it was more action than it was anything, you know, a rundown city, you know, that this guy has to escape from, and it's just a cool little, you know, action movie, which again, he's, you know, he can do it all. I mean, he writes, you know, comedically and has a little action movies in there here and there. I mean, Big Trouble in China had a lot of action in it.
Nothing really sticks to one palette. Nothing really sticks like well, he one
is,
genre. Yes,
of course, he is known for the horror genre because, I mean, there's tons of horror element in most of his movies. But, yeah, I mean, dude, that one for me, third.
Even Escape. The Fog, it was like a dirty gang of pirates. Like, there was a betrayal. Oh, yeah, yeah, there was an underlying, you know, there was a betrayal. And there were lepers. And it was like, dude, this story is all over the place. But it all came together really well.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I think he has, you know, an excessive amount of talent in doing, is bringing 10 different things, putting it in a pot, and just presenting it to you, and it's great.
Yeah. Well, a couple days ago, the video you had sent me of an interview that he did back in, what, in the 70s?
Yeah.
And he was talking about movies with, you know, a message, I guess you could say. And he pretty much said, pretty much like, yeah, that makes more sense. It was pretty much, you know, interviewers asking him about, you know, if movies should have messages and, you know, should pretty much be like deep thought like movies. And he's like, no, they should just be natural. And he was right. He was talking about how movies, when people watch movies, the audience, they're not watching it, you know, trying to be educated or trying to use their brain. It's very emotional. It's a very emotional thing. It's an emotional roller coaster pretty much when you go through a movie. You know, you get scared, you get, you know, angry, sad, you know, happy, whatever. In these moments, you know, but if there is a message, it should come naturally to the movie. It should be like a slowly developing thing and not something that's like the forefront of the movie. Because when you do that, then the movie's just going to be about the message and you're not going to get your story across. There should always be a story. Pretty much is what the interview was. And I thought that was, yeah, like, dude, that's what mainly his movies are, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if you, like, They Live, yeah, you're like, oh, dude, he's seeing, you know, these creatures, and he's, you know, he's the only one who could see him with these glasses, but the underlying, you know, pretty much message that's going through that you start to realize is like, oh, dude, that's...
Yeah, like the elites are really, you know, they're reptiles. They're reptilians.
Yeah.
And, you know, they kind of allude to it, but it's not beating you over the head.
Yeah.
It's not like, hey, cops are corrupt and work for, like, the 1% who are really aliens.
Yeah.
You know, like, a lot of things now come out that extreme, and they come out at that point. But back then, he was kind of just, hey, I'm going to put this out there. You read it how you want to read it. Like, this is how I see it, and it's going to come across. If the movie's good, the message is going to carry itself across.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we've talked about a couple movies here this past year, and actually our first review of this year was a movie that I think had a lot of potential to be really great, but unfortunately they tried to beat you to death with the message, and it came across 5 or 6 times in the movie, and it just kind of ended up faulting the movie, and that's... probably the worst review any movie we've done thus far
has gotten. Our first one was Tarot, but that was more of like, hey, man, I, you know, you showed me this, but then you gave us this.
I was thinking of the first movie of the year being the Wolfman.
Oh, yeah. I was talking about like our first episode.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, the Wolfman, unfortunately, yeah, I think there was a, well, not only that, it was just a slow developing movie, that one was. So.
Yeah.
But that's Wolfman. We're talking about
John
Carpenter. Someone who can actually... no fault to the director of Wolfman.
Stop just... hurting people.
Yeah, man. I mean, dude, I mean, his... I mean, it, again, long overdue to get the star. But, you know, hey, at least now...
It got there.
At least they did it before he...
I was going to say, at least they... Yeah, I think that happens far too much with any form of art. Is that you basically get your accolades after you're gone, and we're like, we're at a loss.
Yeah.
We don't get to appreciate you while we're, you know, while you're here. And, you know, John Carpenter, he's 77 years old. He's not getting any younger. So it's actually good that they actually did, you know, step forward and do that for him. And I thought that it was really telling that Kurt Russell was there for him.
Dude, oh, damn near everybody who's alive, at least.
Yeah.
That's been in his movies was there. Kurt Russell was there. I believe Keith David was there.
He was.
Nick Castle was there. I mean, just pretty much anybody who was in his movies that's still alive was there. Which, again, that just shows you, one, the respect that these actors have for him. I mean, obviously they have respect because they were in multiple of his films. But, dude, just the love, too. I'm like, dude, that's great. That just shows, like, your impact on people. And, of course, the fans that were there, the fans that, you know, just love his stuff, too. I mean, dude, yeah, because you've impacted a lot of people.
And actually, it was kind of funny because I've seen multiple stories on it since it came across on the 3rd. And I've seen probably at least 10 or 12 things have come through my feed showing that. Whereas I can't really definitively remember any time in the past that I remember someone getting their walk, you know, their star on the Walk of Fame being that, you know, that televised or that broadcast. Yeah. You don't see it very often anymore. It used to be like a big thing because, unfortunately, kind of like what we were talking about before we came in, it used to be like you had to have like an extensive body of work. Like you had to, you know, you know, years of experience at the craft. And now it's kind of like, you know, like we were saying, no offense to Luda. I mean, you know, I love the word of mouth album, but, you know, that doesn't deserve a star as much as someone who literally like has such a diversified palette and just comes at you and, you know, has been doing it for decades.
Yeah, that's what. No, I don't know how it works either. I don't know if you could. Again, I had alluded earlier before we started recording about, you know, paying for a star or, you know, what are the qualifications?
I don't really think you can. I think that, you know, because there's a lot of people. It's kind of like, you know, okay, like Beyonce winning, you know, a Grammy for Best Country Album. Yeah. It's kind of like, I think it's like industry buzz. It's, you know, how they put you up and how they personify it, where there's, you know, first of all, Beyonce is not country. So, you know, that being said, I think it definitely, you know, it's what circles you run in. And maybe John Carpenter, due to like some of his beliefs and some of the things he has expressed before, maybe he doesn't run in the right circles that are going to get you those kind of accolades.
Yeah. But then again, I mean, he doesn't need a star.
No.
Just to say the least. But the fact that, what it stands for, I guess you could say, what we, at least we as the audience and fans, see what it stands for. It's like, okay, well, he should have had this a long time ago. If these other people who, I mean, don't have the same, you know, laundry list of credits that does.
And it's also a legacy that goes on. So, like, say, in 30 years, John Carpenter's probably not going to make it to 107. But in 30 years, you'll still be alive. Say you take your child to Los Angeles and you take them to the Walk of Fame, you can be like, hey, this is John Carpenter's star. Like, kids nowadays, like, you know, they don't know who Bob Hope is. Some kids don't know who the heck John Wayne is.
Yeah.
But they have stars. They don't know who Betty Davis is. But these people have stars.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, it's a legacy piece. So it's nice to be remembered. It's nice that, you know, your work carries on even after the mortal coil's gone.
Yeah.
So I that's really like, that's why, you know, we had decided on a different movie. Maybe we'll visit that movie, but we had decided on a different movie. And then when I got home, I was like, man, it came across the feed and I'm like, you know what? I think, you know, we need to take a moment and reflect on, you know, the legacy of John Carpenter. And so that's, you know, that's how this came about. And so, you know, you can give us your comments. Leave us your comment. Dude, let us know.
What are your favorite movies?
Yeah, what are your top three? Why are they your top three?
Yeah. And mind you, my top three, I guess they were kind of in a specific order. I mean, because Halloween was going to be number one no matter what. But, to list them in a list, it would have to be like, okay, what was the, are the practical effects good? Was writing good? This and that. It would have to be down to the last detail to rank every single movie. But, you know, I mean, those are our top three, but yeah, let us know. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll post it on Instagram, you know, after this episode airs, you know, I'll post on Instagram, you know, what were your top three, you know, or heck, you can give us, yeah, top five, top three of your Carpenter movies, why you liked them. I mean, or heck, why you hated them.
Yeah. Why you didn't like them. If you're not a fan, let us know. I mean, you know, it is an open forum here.
Which, with his list of movies, you have to be a fan of at least one of them.
Yeah, there's going to be movies like, I mean,
especially if you grew up with Lost Boys, Vampires has to be at least up there. If you were a vampire, if you were, you know, and if you're sci-fi, you know, Dark Star, you know, Ghosts of Mars, you know, The Thing. Yeah. I mean, there is a movie that he, you know, that he's done. For me, it was Halloween, of course, but also Big Trouble in Little China, you know, the fantasy horror, comedy element that was in that one. I love it to death. But just let us know. I mean he has tons of movie that you can like, and if you don't like, hey, let us know too. Like, hey, F this guy.
Yeah. No. Hey, there's another director that you think, you know, holds the weight, you know. If you're an Eli Roth fan, throw it out there. Yeah. Like,
I mean, the closest I would probably get to would probably be like George Romero.
Yeah.
I mean, that dude, come on, I mean, that right there would probably be a good comparison too. I mean, there's many, many other ones too.
Yeah, but he doesn't really divert. I mean, I'm a Romero fan, don't get me wrong, but he doesn't really
diversify. But he stays kind of, in.
He stays in the zombie genre. He just, you know.
Yeah, he kind of stays.
He builds on that, and that's great. I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely gone the distance.
Oh, yeah, dude.
So, and they're not horrible movies. They, like, quite a few of the newer ones I like better than the older ones.
Yeah.
So.
But, yeah. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of The Legacy of John Carpenter and what we, you know, our favorite movies were. You know, we'll post on Instagram. Let us know what your favorite movies of his are. And we will see you next week.